This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very pleased today to be talking about a really interesting book. It packs a ton of different things into an examination of what might sound like at first to be a really boring subject matter, bureaucratic documents. But actually, what are they doing? Why are they being created? How do they create and reproduce a state's capacity to see, to understand? What kinds of realities do these documents help create? And how might we push back against them? How might we see otherwise? This book, obviously from that description, has quite a lot going for it. So I'm very pleased to welcome the author, Dr. Danielle Taschereau-Mamers, who's written the book Settler Colonial Ways of Seeing, Documentation, Administration, and the Interventions of Indigenous Art, published by Fordham University Press. Danielle, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Could you please start us off by introducing yourself a little bit and explain why you decided to write this book?
So I am Danielle, as you mentioned, and I am currently the managing director of a critical digital humanities research center at the University of Toronto. But in a previous life, I was working as a postdoctoral researcher, doctoral fellow in media studies, and I came to, how did I start to write this book? I came to writing this book out of a sense of deep shame about my lack of understanding of the history of the country in which I was born, which is Canada. And so this book came out of my doctoral research, which began with trying to understand how media has been involved in the creation and propagation of the Canadian settler state, and at the expense of indigenous nations and their legal and political orders. And so I'm thinking about media not in the sense of like film or digital media, things like arts and culture, but thinking about media as like a connector of relations. And so the state structures produce all kinds of media every day in all of the documents that they're constantly producing to record various acts of parliament, all these registration forms, different things you have to fill out. It's tax season right now in North America, so we are feeling the burden of documentary forms in our daily lives here.
Yeah, no, as you talk about in the book, these might seem like documents that don't relate to everyday life, but very clearly they absolutely do in some pretty massive ways. So I want to get into your investigation of kind of visualizing this and examination of other people who have visualized it as well. And I suppose that in some ways goes to answer the next question. You start this book about state documents not in somewhere like Parliament, not even in somewhere like a dusty old archive. You start the book in an art gallery. Why?
I start the book in the art gallery because in an exhibition that I saw at the University of Toronto Art Museum in 2016, I saw this amazing collection of paintings called Premises for Self-Rule by an Indigenous painter, Robert Houle. And in these paintings are diptychs. So there's two panels that are kind of sutured together. One half of each is a painting and the other half is text from various legal documents that have been involved in the settler colonization of Canada. And those texts are reprinted using vinyl on plexiglass. And when I was looking, I went at the suggestion of a friend who knew I was studying the Indian Act. And it was in that gallery that I found myself looking at Canadian law and its documentation for the first time as a visual object rather than as a kind of legal intellectual object. So even though law is written down, like on a piece of paper or in a contemporary moment on digital screens, and we can interact with it visually, we're not often looking at it as a visual object or as a medium that can be incorporated in visual work. And so it took me a while to unpack that interaction with these paintings and with this experience of looking at law. But when I was coming around to the conceptual framing of the book, that was really a watershed moment that started to shape my thinking in different ways about how we might think about media from different perspectives and how that that kind of reappropriation and taking things out of taking texts and documents out of their typical kind of legal bureaucratic spaces and bringing them into places like the art gallery has this ability to decontextualize and recontextualize in a way that opens very different lines of questioning. So that appropriation work is really sparked a lot of interest for me.
Thank you for giving us that opening, because I think that the sparking interest in the different perspectives is, of course, what we're going to go on to explore. And one of the things that taking the documents out of where they're produced is it lets you see kind of the mindset that produced them rather than normalizing it. It kind of goes, hang on, there's a particular perspective at work here. Can you take us through what you mean by the term settler colonial ways of seeing?
Mm-hmm. So there's two kind of big thinkers that are in the back of my mind whenever I'm thinking about that concept. One is John Berger's classic text, Ways of Seeing, really helped me very early on in my academic career. I think I first encountered that as an undergraduate student, to think about seeing as not a just natural biological process, but something that's highly structured and contingent on all sorts of social and political structures that kind of shape our experience of the apprehension and interpretation of the visual world in both visual and non-visual ways. And then the other kind of key intellectual figure that I'm working with here is James Scott. And James Scott wrote this incredible book in the 90s called Seeing Like a State. And in that work, Scott tells us about how states have, even though like a state is composed of laws and processes and claims to power, it's not a single entity and certainly doesn't have an optical capacity. But states are very interested in gathering information and perspectives on those objects that they seek to govern. So things like land, resources, and people are pretty common examples. James Scott uses the example of thinking about a map and how a map is an imperfect kind of abstraction of land where borders can be articulated. And it's really a method of simplifying and using a sort of tunnel vision to only perceive places or people in the ways that sort of fit and suit with the kinds of categories that states have developed for themselves.
Continue.
I guess, clarify the settler colonial modifier is that I'm taking both of these concepts and applying them to the Canadian context and how state seeing has been an important tool in settler colonization of Canada. And that state seeing is the kind of tools, techniques, and outcomes of state seeing have been a place of both oppression of Indigenous peoples, but also a real site of successful Indigenous resistance and creative work.
Okay, so let's get into these sites of resistance. You have a paired approach to your analysis in the book. Can you tell us a little bit about this approach and how and why you developed it?
So I work with visual art and media theory kind of hand in hand throughout the analysis. A very early version of this book, both as my doctoral thesis, as well as probably the first couple drafts of the manuscript, the analytic emphasis was on the media theory part. I think that's partly from trying to be a good girl and pass my dissertation defense in a media studies department. But as I continued to revise and refine my engagement, I guess, intellectual engagement, I wanted the artworks to play a more powerful and kind of foregrounded role in my thinking. And I was really challenged directly by Gerald McMaster, who is an Indigenous curator here in Toronto. And he reviewed an early version of the manuscript and asked me to really think about how can you quote the thought of the artists that's working through these art examples, not necessarily quoting what they've said in interviews, but quoting that work and the intellectual currents running through that work in the same way that I'm attending to close readings of media theorists throughout. And that, as someone who was kind of raised in a fairly traditional social science background, was a real challenge and one that I am still grappling with today. But I'm really trying to foreground, how are these Indigenous artists teaching me about the state's Canadian state methods of documentation and helping me interpret and understand the politics in play there.
All right. So then let's talk about those methods of documentation. What are the four that you look at in the book? And how did you decide these four?
So the book unfolds in not exactly, but more or less chronological chapters. So the first mode of documentation that I look at is the Indian Act, and specific, which is an act that has been rewritten several times, but is an act that at its heart defines who the Canadian state recognizes as a, like, quote unquote, Indian. And so that first mode of documentation there is the definition of Indian and how that has changed over time. The second mode of documentation is registration of those deemed eligible for Indian status. The third is status cards, which is an identity document. And the fourth is, the fourth chapter kind of strays a little bit into a slightly different territory, but thinking about how activists and artists have used modes of documentation that are not exactly the same as the kind of state's genre of documents, but are aligned enough with that they'll be legible to the state to document the crisis of murdered and missing Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit peoples in this country.
And how did you choose those four?
Oh, right. I chose those four because from my perspective, those were how those helped me kind of think through the problem of recognition and erasure, kind of from the moment where the state has created this category through to how this category interacts with and impacts individual people's lives. So I think about documents as a really kind of core way that individual people come in contact with the state. And so this, through the course of exploring these four different types of documentation, they all are showing us different ways and different moments in people's lives where they're coming in contact with a quite violent state side of the structure of the Canadian state.
Hmm. No, that makes sense as a way to kind of bring all these together, despite in some ways their differences, there is that common thread. Given that you've introduced the four bits of documentation, can you introduce us to the artworks you analyze in the book and again explain how you chose these?
My pleasure. Well, I was looking for artworks. At first, people just, you know, when you're doing the great thing about doing a research project is that when you tell people about it, the project expands because they give you ideas. And so a lot of these artworks came my way at the suggestion of colleagues that I was working with. So the book starts, the cover has Nadia Mir's work, Indian Act, which is a beadwork project where Mir and her collaborate and like 200 collaborators beaded over every page of the 1951 Indian Act. There's Robert Houle's Premises for Self-Rule that I described earlier. That's the art gallery where the scene opens. There's an early form of digital art by Cheryl Lurandel called treatycard.ca. And that is a website, which I believe is still active, where one can go in and create your own treaty card. And it includes Cheryl's very tongue-in-cheek description of how one should fill out the different fields that contains a quite wry analysis. There's Howard Adler's photo collages called Status that remix his family photos with an older version of the Status card. And there's a film by TJ Cuthand. Just flipping through because I don't want to miss anyone. I also have a couple of performance works by Rebecca Belmore, a collaborative work called Walking with Our Sisters that involved beading the tops of moccasins. And it closes with a really interesting installation by Tanya Willard called Only Available Light. So it's a very, it's an interesting collection of works. I really wanted to privilege women identified and queer artists. I wanted to have a mix of artists at different kind of stages in their career. It was important to me that the book wasn't just filled with kind of famous folks whose pieces are in the National Gallery, though Indigenous art in Canada has been really marginalized for many, many years. Some readers might be familiar with the names of Rebecca Belmore or Robert Houle, but I suspect not many of them have heard of some of the other artists. And I was also looking for a kind of fairly straightforward selection criteria, was that I was looking for work that engaged directly with these state documents that could help me learn about those documents. And that's a fairly small subset of artwork, though a significant amount of Indigenous art in Canada is grappling with the political, legal, and social implications of settler colonization. But it's a much smaller selection that's dealing with specifically state documents.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Yeah, no, that makes sense as a constraint given the focus, but such an interesting mix of artworks and artists. So thank you for giving us that brief overview of them. I unfortunately don't really have the ability to ask you about each and every single one of them, but I wanted to pick out a few of them to ask you to tell us about in more detail, starting with Nadia Mir's work, if we can. How and what is sort of the impact, I suppose, of this work that, as I understood it, does a lot to kind of make visible the limits of how the government decides, sort of, this person counts as First Nations, this person doesn't. And really that kind of very bureaucratic process that's required to make that determination. How does Nadia Mir's work sort of push back against this or reveal the limits of it?
Yeah, Nadia's work is so important to me. I've learned so much from thinking carefully with this piece over the last few years. So if it's okay, I'll just describe it a little bit for your listeners, because this is an audio format. So Nadia made this work over a period of 2 years, in I believe 2000 to 2002, when she was completing her MFA, 2000 to 2003. And the work involved, she basically like downloaded and printed out the 1951 Indian Act. And in doing so, kind of removed all of the insignia and sort of pomp and circumstance that's around, that you would see if you looked at a version of the law in the federal archives. So the arms of Canada are removed. It's just the text of the law that's printed out on regular letter paper. And so in that step, she's already removing the law from these kind of hallowed halls and into the more ordinary space of bureaucracy and kind of where the action and impact of that law tend to happen. Then she worked with 200 volunteers and held regular kind of meeting sessions where she and several other experienced beaters would give lessons and they would share stories. But in the process of beating, the group covered over every page. There's 56 pages of text where they filled in all the white space with red beads and used a white bead to cover every printed letter. And some of the panels are left incomplete, which is, I think those are incredibly interesting pieces because then you see the process at work. It's a collective project, so there's no way of knowing who stitched which bead. The beaders were a mix of Indigenous and non-Indigenous participants, and it happened both at the gallery and in an Indigenous Friendship Center in Montreal. So kind of decentralizing and moving around the community. And interesting, one of the lessons that I learned from this work is that Nadia is, so when it is exhibited, it's 56 framed pieces. And I think that framing, the repetitive framing, for me really helped me kind of find a visual metaphor for thinking about the framing and constraint of the legal definition of status. It's also in the invisibility of, or not invisibility, in the inability to decipher who stitched which bead, if this was stitched by an Indigenous person or a non-Indigenous person, the work really tries to make ambiguous the specific identities that this law is trying to reproduce. But it doesn't do that in this kind of easy, all people are the same kind of multicultural, easy turn to multiculturalism. I also really enjoy kind of trying to imagine what those sessions must have been like and the kinds of storytelling and knowledge sharing that I am presuming would have drawn on some Indigenous, some customary knowledge of the Indigenous beaters who were there, sharing an art form that often is passed down traditionally associated with women. And so it's there's a lot of layers going on here. But the final kind of theoretical guide that I pulled from this is just thinking about how many hands are touching this paper, how many hands have been involved in kind of perforating the paper, stringing the bead, that it's one bead after another. And that kind of repetition, the combination of both hands and repetition, helped me think further, and I carry this through the book, to think about how all paperwork and all administration is a human practice. It's humans repeating the implementation of law through its documents, or humans resisting that implementation in creative ways.
I'd like, in fact, to turn to another one of those creative ways that humans resist the documentation. I'm so glad in your overview of the art earlier, you called the treatycard.ca website snarky. I definitely got that vibe from it, and obviously therefore have to ask you about it. What exactly is this website doing? What ways of seeing is it disrupting, and how is it doing it?
I don't know if I would say snarky, but it's definitely a little sassy. So this website is a kind of, it's a counter registration technique. So the Canadian States Indian Register, or involves like trying to distance the individual human from the process as much as possible. So you submit a registration form. That the contemporary one is similar in some ways to applying for a passport. All kind of state identification involves trying to separate the individual being identified from the proof of that identity. And Cheryl Durandel in treatycard.ca is having none of that. So she's inviting users to come to this website and create their own treaty card. She uses the term treaty card, which comes from Western Canadian slang, which is almost all parts of the prairies and kind of west of, I guess, like the middle of Ontario, are part of the numbered treaty system, which was a series of treaties that were signed in the very late 1800s and early 1900s. So Cheryl is asking us, the kind of wry humor in it is most prevalent in her instructions. And so she describes the project as an opportunity, and I'll just read here for you to quote, obtain one's own personal facsimile of the government issue if you've been feeling left out of the club. And so she's asking, there's often a quite racist connotation around treaty cards or status cards in Canada, that they allow Indigenous people to like have special benefits and privileges that Canadian citizens are not, settler Canadians are not privy to. And there are indeed some small benefits, but largely it's a sign of being sutured into a system of colonization. But Cheryl says, never let the words, I wish I had a treaty card, pass your lips again. Sign up today. And so in her card, she plays with and gives a lot of freedom that the state's registration form does not. So she invites you to give your given first name, and then also offers a space to give a surname or colonized name, indicating that many, many Indigenous people were forced to change their names during the treaty process. She asks for an alias or original or chosen name, date of birth, place and origin of birth. And in the place and origin of birth, she asks, invites users of the website to kind of consider whose land they've been born onto. So another kind of prompt to really do a little bit of self-reflection. And then at the end, anyone who fills out this little form, you get an image pops up that you can download and print off. And your name is also added to her treaty card register, which the point of the register for the Canadian government is to have a clear number of just how many status Indians are in Canada. And Lurandel's register, of course, is completely useless in this regard. And so she's playing within these very familiar structures of registration, but at each point asking for reflection on the impact of settler colonization on identity, representation, self-representation, on how she's prompting us to think about cliches or connotations that people might hold towards status card and treaty card. So it's seemingly on the face of it is a quite simple website, but there's a lot going on under the surface.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Thank you for talking us through kind of the multiple connotations and layers of that. So I'd like to stay on the topic, please, of status cards for a little bit, because you do have other art in the book that discusses them, that pushes back against them, that exposes the limits of them. Can you perhaps talk about some of the films you analyze in the book that contest status cards?
I would love to. So one film in particular that I could speak to is T.J. Cuthand's short film titled There's a Cut Hand is an Indian Within the Meaning of the Indian Act. And in this film, it a lot of the drama is in the narration. So in the visuals show TJ moving around an interior space. We're moving around a small town. But in the narration, they're describing how they came to have a status card, which is through an omission that TJ's mother made on his birth certificate. Omitting TJ's father because his father didn't have status at the time. And this this part of the narration is prompting a reflection on and is pointing to the sex discrimination that's deeply embedded in the Indian Act that made it very difficult for women to maintain status outside of a heteropatriarchal relationship with a man holding status. Throughout the film, TJ reflects on experiences that they have had with everyday racism as a lighter skinned individual moving through space with a darker skinned family. So being kind of tailed by cops in the mall and the experience of moving between communities and cultures. Another part that really helped me think about kind of connecting back to the repetition that I mentioned in Nadia Mir's work, TJ describes the repetitive times in which he's required to show his status card in order to access things that are owed to him via him and all Indigenous people due to treaty. And so there's one particularly painful part where TJ is describing trying to get a prescription for antidepressants and being unable to access the brand name medication because the healthcare that that status Indians are able to access will only cover the generic, even though the generic gives them terrible side effects. And so the narration just really kind of brings home the how this legislative structure, the Indian Act, comes to bear on individual lives day in and day out, and that it's a constant having to present oneself within the frame through which the state is seeing you, but not necessarily the frame through which you understand yourself, kinship, familial relations, and histories. And so towards the end of the film, TJ talks about when you're looking at the status card, when you're looking at him, would you know that four generations back, his great-grandfather fought the Canadian government in the Battle of Cutknife Hill, that he has medicine people on both sides of his family. So the narration of the film is really helping bringing into kind of tension and distinction this rich and multi-layered familial past and the just the flat narrowness of status as articulated and applied through the Indian Act.
No, that definitely adds extra layers to our discussion already about status cards. So thank you for adding that in. I'd like to turn to another aspect or another issue that you discuss in the book, the massive challenge, obviously, of missing and murdered Indigenous women and Two-Spirit people, and the challenges of making this crisis visible and in some ways, the challenge is kind of how do you make something like that visible? You talk about in the book multiple different ways, sort of statistical methods, more kind of traditionally artistic approaches. Can you talk about what these are and how they're trying to both make the crisis visible, but also negotiate tensions between sort of what mode does one use and how do they relate to each other?
So many, many activists have been working on this issue, some in particular who have produced some really powerful reports. Are the Native Women's Association of Canada, NWAC, and activists who have been working with the support of Amnesty International. And so the challenge through this kind of reporting has been to generate the kinds of statistics that might be legible and intelligible to state agents, that might kind of move the needle and make a headline. But with a real fear of the kind of flattening power of a statistic and not wanting the lives of sisters and mothers, women, to be flattened into that numerical space. And so a very interesting approach that the Sisters in Spirit reports produced by the Native Women's Association of Canada took was to generate statistics. There's a lot of graphs in those reports. But those statistics are paired with detailed stories about women who have disappeared or who were killed that were drawn from family interviews. There's, of course, a real barrier. Canada is a very large country, and many Indigenous communities are located in very remote places. So there's significant cost involved in producing these reports. But NWAC did an amazing job at really bringing some real attention to that crisis. Other ways that that artists have pursued the question of magnitude. One example is Rebecca Belmore's performance Vigil, where she uses repetition in many ways. She calls out names of missing women. She writes their names on her body. She cleans and creates a ceremonial space on the street. There's a lot of visceral physicality in that performance. And she performed it had a similar performance several years later called 11,041. I think I want to get this right. 1,181. And for that piece, Rebecca hammered 1,181 nails into a piece of wood. And she did that in Queen's Park, which is where the Ontario provincial legislature is located. And again, there's this sense of repetition that doesn't produce a calculable number, but produces a kind of emotional weight. And a second artistic endeavor is the Walking with Our Sisters ceremony. This was a ceremony that was produced in collaboration with many, many Indigenous artists across the country, where in response to a call for volunteers and donations by Christy Belcourt, who's an Indigenous artist, people... The top of a moccasin that kind of goes over the top of the foot is called a vamp. And so people beaded the top of the vamp in memoriam of women and children who had been missing or killed. And the ceremony laid out these vamps along a pathway of fabric, and participants in the ceremony were invited to remove their shoes, to walk through the ceremonial space and release it with and observe all of these individual vamps, these beadwork. They were all different from one another. Some were tributes to specific women. Others were reflecting on community. There were many different beadwork motifs and styles involved. And in that piece, again, you have this this kind of real sense of magnitude, as well as specificity in trying to grapple with that loss of life.
That really does seem to be the key there, magnitude and specificity at the same time. Really tricky balance, but some fascinating ways that it's being done. So thank you for sharing those with us. What do you hope readers take away from all of this, from the book, obviously that has much more detail than we've been able to get into, but from this discussion generally?
I hope that readers will learn a little bit more about the ongoing processes of settler colonization in Canada, and learn that this is not just something that happened in the 1870s, but is a political structure that is alive and well and being reproduced every day in this country. I also hope that readers will maybe come away with a sense of how documents, how powerfully documents connect individual lives to state political and legal practices. And that it's easy to feel overwhelmed and kind of suffocated by the sort of traps that paperwork make for us. Like, many, many people, not just Indigenous people, have been caught in loops of paperwork where there's one form that needs another form that needs another form in order to get some kind of recognition that's always partial and always limited. And it can be, I think it's very easy to feel powerless within that system. But I think that for me, I learned throughout this work that art can be a really powerful kind of imaginative escape hatch from the weight of those political structures. And so towards the end of the book, I refer to my dear friend Matt Wildcat and his collaborator Justin De Leon. They talk about how Indigenous sovereignties can create an in-between space, a space between what is. So there's a kind of diagnostic analysis of the state we're in right now, and what could be. And so there's also an imaginative side that's kind of building, actively building and hoping and working towards different futures. And I think the creative work of Indigenous artists really is leading the way in kind of creating that in-between space of sovereignty and helping imagine relations kind of written otherwise that aren't so contingent on or contained by bureaucratic rationalities and colonial commitments. So yeah, when paperwork's getting you down, when the state is getting you down, look to the artists, because they might have some new ideas and new options for you to think about.
What a wonderful thing to almost end on, because I do have, in fact, one final question. This book came out in 2023. Is there anything you've been working on since or currently working on, whether or not it's a book, whether or not it's on this exact topic, that you'd like to preview or highlight?
I would love to. I've been working on, I was started in parallel while I was finishing this book, and really trying to dig into that. I spoke a little bit earlier about how difficult it was for me to work with art as a kind of source of theory and trying to find ways to let the artworks and the artistic strategies lead my analysis in the same way that I am very comfortable and well-trained in letting political theory and media theory lead my analysis. And I was sharing these struggles with my dear friend, Dr. Marta Bashovsky. And like any good academic venting session, we decided that we had to write a different book. And so we have slowly been working away on a new, it's going to be a very short book called Art as Thought, A Methods Manifesto. And it's going to argue for thinking with art rather than using it as a kind of interesting anecdote or clever conclusion to to work in international relations and political theory. And so it's part part a bit of our complaints about how sometimes this work is done, part letters to one another where we share some of the struggle with learning how to think with art, and part just practical tips for getting started with thinking and writing with art in new ways. So we are finishing, I'm going to say it here so we actually do it. We're going to be finishing the draft this summer and looking for publishers. So if anyone's interested, call me up.
Wow. Well, that sounds like a fascinating project. Thank you for the sneak preview. And hopefully it finds a publisher and we can have you back and you can tell us all about it. But of course, in the meantime, while you finish that draft, listeners can read the book we've been discussing titled Settler Colonial Ways of Seeing, Documentation, Administration, and the Interventions of Indigenous Art, published by Fordham University Press. Danielle, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thank you for having me. It was my pleasure.